we're pleased to have this morning as a visiting judge, Judge Charles Blyle. To my right, Justice Bob McCoy, of course, you see regularly. And I'm Leanne Dofino. You are the only case we have set for oral submission today, and I know you had to travel a distance. We appreciate it. Even from Arlington, it's a distance. So we'll get started. I understand both sides are ready. Is that correct? Okay. Then if you call the first case, or the only case.
The court will now call University of Texas at Arlington v. Sandra and Steve Williams. And may it please the court, Mr. Kevin Molina, the author of the appellant, and Ms. Kimberly Fitzpatrick, the author of the appellant.
All right. Thank you.
And may it please the court. In this interlocutory appeal of a plea to the jurisdiction, this court should reverse the trial court's denial of that plea and render judgment dismissing all claims against the University of Texas at Arlington. And there are essentially two reasons in the alternative why the court should do this. The first has to do with the nature of the activity that was being engaged in by the appellees at the time of the injury. And once again, as you've read in the briefing, it is our allegation that that activity was a recreational use under the recreational use statute in CPRC. And as a result of that activity having been a recreational use on recreational use type property, the standard that the appellee would have had to plead in the trial court and show is that UTA acted with gross negligence.
Well, let me ask you this. If we read down the list of examples, which I have highlighted and I cannot put my hand on at the moment.
Yes, sir.
Every one of these activities has the individual participating in it. Even if it's bird watching, they are participating in it. And sitting on a bleacher is not participating in a recreational activity.
Well,
it's watching it, but it's not participating.
Well, Your Honor, with due respect, I believe that there are sort of a couple of activities on this list whose sort
Where
of,
is the list that I cannot find?
Sir, it's in CPRC section
75.001.
Where in the red and blue stuff?
Oh, in the red and blue stuff. You know what? I don't know that I have it. Oh, actually,
okay.
I believe it's in
here,
her brief.
It's on page 11 of Appellee's brief.
Yes,
okay.
Correct.
Let's look at those and see if there's any of them that are not a participatory activity.
Well, Your Honor, before we do that, I'd like to sort of clarify what this notion of participation is. As we've briefed, I believe that there are sort of two different types of participation that are evident in the list. The first is people who are participating in sort of either athletic or things where they're actually sort of doing the thing.
Okay.
And that is like swimming, I think, is the best example of that.
What would be an example that's there in the list that you're not doing the thing? That's my point.
Well, but doing the thing sometimes is an active thing, and doing the thing sometimes is a sedentary thing that involves more observation of what's going on around you than it does actually doing something.
But you're like bird watching.
Like bird and
but you and, are participating in the bird watching. You are doing it.
You are watching it. That's correct.
So in my mind, you know, when you have the catch-all phrase at the end of this list, any other activity, blah, 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 that catch-all list should reflect the previous list of those were examples of what this is supposed to be.
Yes, sir.
And in my mind, all the examples are that word.
Well, yes, sir.
Participatory. Activities.
Although I think it's interesting that the justice sort of makes the sort of field glasses sign when you're bird watching, because typically you associate bird watching with taking out a pair of binoculars and a guidebook and going out to some place where the birds are and you look at the birds and find who they are and you match them to the book. Well, imagine you go to a baseball game, right? And you go to the baseball game because you're one of these people that keeps score. And so what you have in your hand is a piece of paper that marks every at-bat, and you have your field glasses in exactly the same way as you'd be bird watching. You're looking at what's going on in the field. You're saying, okay, you know, ball one, I mark it. Ball two, I mark it. You know, hit, he gets the second base, I mark that. I beg your pardon?
Was that going on here in this case?
Well, Your Honor, to the extent that, not necessarily to that extent, but once again, the actual observation of the game, whether you've gone to just watch the game because you're a fan of the game, or whether because you're one of those sort of sports nuts that like needs to mark everything down, either of those things are participation in the diversion of watching a sporting event. And once again, to the extent that we're talking about someone that participates in something, when you go to a sporting event for the purpose of specifically for the purpose of watching it, you are then participating in the watching or the spectating or the observation of that sporting event. And once again, that is very similar to bird watching in all those same ways. You know, you bring the same sorts of things. You know, when you go to bird watch, you don't interact with the birds directly. In fact, that's you know, that you can't do that. You'll scare them off, right? You have to keep your distance, because the main thing that you are doing by participating in bird watching, you're being sedentary so as not to scare the birds, and you're observing. And that's, once again, very similar to what happens when you go to a sporting event. You know, you don't get to interact with the players when you're in the gallery. What you do is you sit in your seat, you take your field glasses, you watch what's going on the field. Your participation is observing what's happening on the field.
And so you're saying if somebody had videotaped the game or the birds, and you were sitting in a classroom watching them, and the roof fell in on you because you were watching a sporting event, there would be no liability on the part of anybody?
Well, no, ma'am. A couple of things there. First off, obviously, recreational use doesn't eliminate liability. It just changes the standard for the premises defect. But more importantly, sort of when you're looking at these activities, you have to look at the actual facts in the case that you're talking about. And in this case, what we have is what's undisputed is that the stadium that was that where they participated, where they watched the game, was an outdoor stadium. Exactly the sort of structure that's contemplated in the definitions of the recreational use statute. Now, the fact that that could have been done indoors, or it could have been done via videotape or whatever, that's all true. But if you look at several other things that, when you look at the jurisprudence for the recreational use statute, I think probably the best example is playground equipment. Because, right, the Supreme Court has said, you know, going to the park to use playground equipment is akin to picnicking. Now, I'm not necessarily sure I follow that, because I believe that picnicking is sort of one of those sedentary things, whereas playing on playground equipment is an active thing. I mean, you have to swing from the monkey bars to be using the monkey bars. But once again, go with me on this. The fact of the matter is that you can have monkey bars and swings and slides and ball pits. All those things can be indoors or outdoors. Right. If you go to a big enough McDonald's, you'll see they have a playground that's in the McDonald's, and within a structure which couldn't ever be outdoors, wouldn't fit under the recreational use statute, you have playground equipment. Now, if a child was injured in one of those structures, that wouldn't fall under the recreational use statute, even though doing that exact same activity outdoors at a park would, and we know it would because the Supreme Court has said that that's the sort of activity that definitely falls under the recreational use statute. And so the notion that the activity that's being engaged in is something that could have been done inside is not dispositive, because a lot of these activities can be done indoors or outdoors. But the fact of the matter is, in this case, it's undisputed that it was done in an outdoor facility, and because it was done in an outdoor facility that falls under the definition of a premises in the recreational use statute, the recreational use statute applies.
Well, how do you address the wedding case where the Supreme Court talks about a wedding is not the type of activity in which people engage assuming a risk of injury from physical activity, kind of like sitting. We believe there to be something more, an activeness, a physical exertion, an immersion in the physical elements of nature that is essential to finding activity associated with enjoying nature or the outdoors.
Well, Your Honor, you're referring to the Sullivan case, and I think there's actually a couple of different ways that we can deal with Sullivan. The first is, and the most important is, the actual holding in Sullivan is that attending an outdoor wedding itself is not a recreational use. And when you look at, I believe that...
Wait a minute. What's the difference between watching a bird and watching a wedding?
Well,
bride.
Well, according to the Sullivan Court, the difference is this: that a wedding has what they refer to as a ceremonial intent, which is to say the point of a wedding is to make that social contract between those two people. And so, as a result, it's not something that you go to spectate for entertainment. It's, once again, you're there, but you're not but your entertainment is not the reason you're there. The reason that you're there is because those people are forming a social contract, and that ceremonial activity is what makes it different. different from, you know, going outside to see the old ball game. I think just strictly on its holding, Sullivan distinguishes from the facts that you have in front of you, because once again, there's no ceremonial purpose to a soccer game. I mean, a soccer game is there for kids to play in.
Soccer? There's no ceremonial purpose for soccer?
In a soccer game, yes, ma'am. That's correct. In other words, there's no sort of binding of people, you know, till death do they part as a result of the kids playing soccer. The kids play soccer because it's good for them, you know, because they enjoy it. And then the parents come and watch it, as the record in this case indicates. The parents come and watch the game because they enjoy going to the ball game. It's the same reason almost anyone goes to a ball game.
Mr. Molina,
yes, sir.
I know the statute was substantially amended in 1981, but when was it first enacted?
You know, you got me there, Your Honor. I believe it was sometime in the late 60s. And I believe that I'm not sure of the date, although I know that when it was very first enacted, I believe there were only three activities that were listed in the list. It was hunting and fishing and camping, I think.
Well, do you know how many times since the statute was enacted that the Attorney General has requested the legislature to include spectating activities?
I do not know that. No, sir.
Do you know how many times that any city or municipality or county has asked the legislature to include that?
I do not, Your Honor. Although I would mention that, that apart from sort of the 1981 amendment, it's been actually amended several times since then.
Yes.
I'm not exactly sure of the number of times, but I would note that each time that it's been amended, sort of the list of things that sort of count as recreational use has gradually expanded, as well as the types of properties that were involved. When it was first passed, it was actually limited to just agricultural use properties. If we were going under that version of the statute, obviously we wouldn't be here right now because, you know, Maverick Stadium is not an agricultural property. But the fact of the matter is as the recreational use statute has gone on, essentially the number of things that it covers, both activity and property-wise, has expanded consistently. And I believe, Your Honor, that it wouldn't be necessary to say, we're gonna say that spectating a sporting activity is an activity that's covered, because I believe at some point the legislature decided to put that catch-all in that said, you know, any other activity associated with enjoying nature of the outdoors. I think that very clearly covers this.
Don't you think there's a big difference between doing something and spectating whatever?
I do, Your Honor. But at the same time, because both of those types of activities are covered in the list, if you're going to apply the adjudicatum generis policy or method of reading statutes to it, because you have both of those different types of activities in the same list, when you're looking at the catch-all and deciding, okay, is this other activity that's not on the list that we're trying to fit in the catch-all, is it like one of those two categories of activities? In other words, is it like the swimming, you know, camping, hunting, active activities, or is it like the nature study, picnicking, sedentary activities? Well, because it's more like the nature hunting, sedentary activities.
Where is nature hunting?
I misspoke, Your Honor. Nature study, I'm confusing nature study with hunting. And I'm thinking that hunting is a more active one. And hunting is one of those sort of activities where it's like you can imagine exactly what the sort of injury that a person would sustain when they were hunting. And I mean, that really gets right to the core of what Sullivan is trying to say, is that, well, the rule is you have to be able to, it only protects or it only provides that limitation of liability in situations where a person engages in an activity where they understand sort of what the potential harm is. I believe that, sort of getting back to the way you deal with Sullivan, I believe that's largely dicta in Sullivan, first off, because once again, that holding actually is strictly that going to a wedding is not a recreational use. And because we're not talking about a wedding here, I believe it distinguishes on the facts. But at the same time, what the Sullivan court, I believe, it cites that 1981 expansion, but what that 1981 expansion says is, you know, we're sort of opening the door to more different types of activities. And I think it's key that 1981 expansion included picnicking. And while we might talk about whether picnicking also includes swinging on the monkey bars or playing in an impromptu game of soccer, the fact of the matter is that the definition of picnicking that the Fort Worth Court of Appeals used was pretty much just people bringing food to a common table and eating outside, which didn't include swinging on monkey bars. It didn't include playing an impromptu soccer game. All it involved is sitting on the grass and eating a sandwich. And once again, I don't know that that's the sort of activity that people enter into expecting to get a particular particular kind of injury, like hunting or like swimming, but it's on the list, and we know that the legislature meant it to be on the list. And so when we're once again interpreting sort of what all can fit into that catch-all, then that's the sort of sedentary activity that's very much like going to the ball game and getting a hot dog, sitting in the bleacher and watching the game, Your Honor. So that said,
Mr. Molina,
yes, sir.
I had a friend who just recently died at 94.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Well, me too. She was a friend of a lot of people. But at any rate, she had a great-grandson who played high school football. And I went to some of the games in which he played, and I never went to a game when she wasn't there. And I can, and she needed help getting to, up and down the steps, but she did it. But I can't see, and soccer and football are different, but I don't see that she was in any way participating or taking a risk. And that's what the statute goes to, is some risk involved.
Your Honor, with due respect, I believe once again with respect, I believe with that properly describes one category of activity that are included in the list, which once again I think the best example with the most jurisprudence is swimming. That's the sort of activity that people enter into expect. And Your Honor, may I please have extra time to finish the answer?
Yeah. Go ahead.
That is the sort of activity that people enter into with that understanding that risk that injury could occur. Okay, but once again, when you have the inclusion of additional activities, a second category of activities, which are the more sedentary, observational type activities, which are bird watching and picnicking, that when you're deciding once again whether another activity that fits inside can be in that catch-all, it can be in either one of those categories. And so while it's true that going to the stadium to watch those football games would not have been the same thing as hunting, because you wouldn't have the risk of frankly being shot, and it wouldn't be the same as swimming because you wouldn't have the risk of drowning, at the same time, that's true that there is no inherent risk with picnicking either, and there's no inherent risk with bird watching either. And that means that because those activities are also on the list, that means that other things that fit in the catch-all can also be of that variety, that category of activities, which do not carry an inherent risk. And in that respect, I do believe that Sullivan is not correctly decided in that part. But once again, I believe that part is dicta. But
let me ask, is there a difference between soccer and football in what I'm talking about? And
As far as being a spectator at it, no, sir. In fact, the case that we're citing to you as the primary sort of what should be the model for this case, the Anderson case, is actually a baseball case. And so that would be even a third sport. But once again, like the Waco Court of Appeals found, you know, going to that game to watch the game, that's a diversion. That's something that fits into the recreational use statute because it is itself a diversion and recreation.
I grew up in Houston. There was a municipal auditorium, coliseum, and let's say I was in a city that had a municipal theater or coliseum, and Les Mis came to town, and I wanted to see it, and I put on my nice clothes and paid $60 for a decent seat and went and saw that. Is that any different than what this person did?
With respect, no, Your Honor. But once again, I think that sort of the key fact that I'm not sure that I picked up from your hypothetical is, are we talking about an outside performance or are we talking about an indoor performance?
Well, let's say either one.
Well, but once again, as we sort of discussed earlier, I believe that is a very important fact that distinguishes those two fact situations. Once again, because many of the activities that are listed and that are in the jurisprudence are activities that could be performed either indoors or outdoors. But once again, the court found that it was applicable because it was undisputed that it was outdoors.
So if you played in Cowboys Stadium, this same soccer game, we wouldn't have this case. Is that right?
That's correct.
Do you think that's a logical legal difference?
I do think it's a logical legal difference. And once again, like you, I mean, I don't write these things. The statute itself basically makes it clear that when you are taking part in something that is outdoors, that potentially the recreational use statute applies.
And the legislature, which does write these things, has had the opportunity time and time again to put spectating in, and they've declined and declined and declined.
Well, Your Honor, I would submit that what they've done, instead of having to list out every single activity that they could have possibly thought of, instead they've put the catch-all in that says any other activity associated with enjoying the outdoors. And once again, like the analysis goes in Anderson, you know, going out to the old ball game is one of the classic sort of human ways of enjoying the outdoors, of going outside, of basically engaging in a recreational use of property.
I can understand if Judge Blau goes to a ball game, he can anticipate the possibility of being hit by a baseball. But what injury does he anticipate going to see Les Mis?
Well, once again, Your Honor, I do not believe that any sort of associated type of injury with the activity is actually any part of the analysis. Now, while I realize that that's the analysis that's in Sullivan, what Sullivan does is it relies on that 1981 sort of expansion of the legislature by the legislature of the recreational use statute. What Sullivan, on that point, importantly does not do is cite to any actual language in the recreational use statute. And if you look at our reply brief, you know, we point that out as such, as opposed to sort of limiting it to any sort of, you know, you can only be covered, you know, with respect to an activity you're doing if there is some activity or if there is some injury that you would naturally associate with that. But if you look at the jurisprudence, I mean, especially if you look at like the Hamaki case, for instance, Hamaki case is just somebody walking across the floor. Now, they had been playing golf earlier that day. They were in the clubhouse of the golf room, but once again, but the recreational use statute applied, even though the injury was sustained just walking across the floor. So whether that's something that you would anticipate as being associated just with golf or associated with like walking out to my car when this argument is over, I mean, I think that that's sort of neither here nor there. The fact of the matter is, if once you are engaged in the recreational use on the property, anything that you do, anything that you do that might subject the owner or to liability is now limited by the recreational use statute. It is not limited to just injuries that you would associate with the activity that the person was engaged in. And once again, apart from Sullivan, I'm not aware of any other cases in all of the state where that connection is made.
Are there any other questions? Any other questions? Do you have any other questions? All right, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Give her some extra time.
Oh, yeah, they're the only argument. We have questions. Go ahead. If we're asking you questions or you have more to say when your time your red light goes off, we'll allow you time to finish up.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, how do you get over picnicking? I mean, if I'd been in the trial court, I would have probably brought a red and white check tablecloth, whipped it out on counsel table, put a lunchbox there and sit there and say, Judge, this is covered. Then I'd have gone back and sat in the bleachers and say, now I'm sitting in the stands. This must be covered too because there's no difference between the two. Now, how do you distinguish picnicking from sitting in bleachers?
The difference between picnicking and sitting in bleachers, Your Honor, is that the picnicking occurs outdoors in the nature. And if you, there's some great reasoning in the City of Waco versus Kierwin case where it talks about nature and the things that you could encounter, for instance, while you're bird watching, as you guys were discussing earlier. For instance, the cliffs, the rushing river, concealed snakes, those type of things that someone might encounter while they're at a park picnicking. In this situation, we're at the Maverick Stadium. There's it's not surrounded by a bunch of trees, and we believe that the record does not reflect that Ms. Williams was engaged in any type of physical activity as was mentioned earlier. There were no binoculars, there were no scorekeeping, there was no videotape, no pictures, anything of that nature.
But that's the Waco court?
No, on the Waco court, we believe that the Waco court, its reasoning is incorrect. We believe that instead of using the statutory definition provided by the legislature, which provided 15 categories of activities refer to, the Waco court went to the Webster's Dictionary definition of recreation. The definition to recreation was, you know, pastime, so they further went to look up the definition of pastime provided by Webster's. So we believe that the reliance on that case is that case should not be relied on, that the case that we use to support our brief is the Sullivan case, that this court has already discussed. We believe that Ms. Williams had to be immersed in a physical activity at the time that she was injured. And in fact, I wanted to talk about the Torres case that we cited in our brief as well. The Torres case states that that the activity at the time of the injury controls whether the recreational use statute applied, not the injured party's purpose for entering the land. And the activity here is Ms. Williams was waiting to pick up her daughter after the soccer game. The soccer game was over. She wasn't spectating during the soccer game. She was standing along a railing at the foot of the bleachers waiting to pick up her child. Appellees do not believe that this is the type of activity that the legislature intended to fall within the recreational use statute. And as in the Sullivan v. City of Fort Worth case, we believe that the activity that the injured party had to engage in had to bear some risk of danger, such as the hunting, the fishing, the camping. And this honorable court previously found that the wedding is not type of activity in which people engage assuming a risk of injury from physical activity, and that a wedding does not transform a ceremony to recreation simply because it occurred outside. This honorable court believed there had to be something more, as mentioned, an activeness, a physical exertion, or immersion in the physical elements of nature that is essential to finding an activity associated with enjoying the outdoors. Because the legislature chose to define the meaning of recreation within the context of the statute, the Waco court erred in expanding the definition of recreation to include the common meaning of the word. If the legislature's objective was to include the Webster's Dictionary definition of recreation and pastime, there would have been no need for the legislature to define recreation in a statute. Because the legislature did choose to define recreation, it must be construed to, according to its legislative definition. And in fact, the spectating at a soccer game isn't even within the class of activities that the legislature has listed. Sitting, watching your child at a soccer game or picking up your child at a soccer game isn't in the same physical class as the cases that are cited in the appellant's brief, such as playing on playground equipment, playing golf, picnicking, hiking, those types of activities that are cited in some of those cases. With regard to the duty that UTA owed Sandra Williams, the record reflects that Ms. Williams and Mr. Williams paid for admission to the soccer game, and Arlington ISD paid to use the facility. Accordingly, UTA owed Sandra Williams the duty owed to an invitee. Appellees do not believe that Ms. Williams' injury falls within the recreational use statute. However, if this court finds that it does, appellees have stated a claim for gross negligence as required by the Texas Tort Claims Act. The acts and omissions of UTA, which were grossly negligent, include there is a set of portable stairs at the bottom of the bleachers, and there was a 5-foot drop-off from where Ms. Williams was standing and the track. The UTA staff had removed the portable stairs on that day. The UTA failed to fix the swinging gate that Ms. Williams was leaning against, had a original latching system on the gate that secured the gate. That system had broke off sometime in the past, and nobody decided to fix it, you know, the way that it was. Instead, some of UTA's agents created a makeshift remedy where they used a chain and a non-weight-bearing padlock to secure the gate. So when they removed the stairs, you know, this system was in place. UTA's agents never safety tested the chain and padlock remedy to be sure it was adequate to secure the swinging gate or capable of weight-bearing. In fact, Thomas Clausa, the UTA's facilities manager, had stated in his deposition that these locks had to be replaced on a consistent basis in the past, that they were never tested to make sure that they were weight-bearing, and they found that sometimes when they were going around the track that the locks just came undone. And so, you know, we believe that it was grossly negligent. These same locks that you found to be that UTA found to be...
Or at least there's a fact question.
Correct. Yes. UTA also never posted any signage on the railing to warn the thousands of spectators that visit the stadium each year that that gate posed a dangerous condition.
Okay, well, we just give a heads up to opposing counsel that we're going to ask him, why is that not some evidence that at least constitutes a fact question about gross negligence?
And lastly, I would like to touch on the fact that we believe that the trial court did not err in denying appellant's motion to dismiss the claims of appellee Steve Williams, a derivative claimant. Steve Williams is Sandra Williams' husband. He's sued for loss of consortium. UTA has alleged that Steve Williams failed to give notice as required by Section 101.101 of the Texas Civil Practice and Remedies Code. UTA had immediate actual knowledge of the fall and that Sandra Williams sustained physical injuries. The record reflects that Thomas Clausa, UTA's facilities manager, was notified of the accident before the police even arrived on the scene. Steve Williams was present at the accident scene and identified himself as Ms. Williams' husband, as noted in the offense incident report, where Officer Morrison provided her husband with a business card and phone number. Officer Morrison also noted that Ms. Williams broke her arm. The formal notice provided to UTA included the identity and contact information for Steve Williams and identified him as her husband. The facts in Appellee's case mirror the facts in the Sullivan v. Aransas County case, not the facts in the Santana case. This case is similar to the Sullivan v. Aransas case because Steve Williams was present when the injury occurred and spoke to UTA's agents immediately after the accident. Further, Sandra Williams was the only person injured, and because Steve Williams' claims are derivative in nature, they fall within that same statutory cap of $250,000 that applies to Sandra Williams. Appellee Steve Williams did not have a separate accident or injury and is not making a bystander claim. Accordingly, the notice provided to the state on May 28, 2010 was sufficient to put them on notice that a derivative claim might be asserted as a result of Sandra Williams' injury.
Okay. You're not making a bystander claim. What are you making?
A derivative claim.
For what?
Loss of consortium.
How would they know that her injury would yield a loss of consortium?
Getting
into detail there, but.
She broke her arm, and she was her injuries were very severe. She had to have surgery. In the notice provided to the state, we set forth the injuries, and we also set forth his name and relationship and contact information. And there's some case law, for instance, the Santana. I'm sorry, just one moment.
I mean, I'm hearing you, bystander claim. He's there, he witnesses what happened. Okay, there's no dispute about that. But consortium claim, I'm kind of struggling to get there from what they knew at the time.
In the Sullivan v. Aransas case, it was a similar similar in the fact that the husband, one of the spouses were injured. The other spouse was there. They were put on notice of the spouse being there and aware of his identity. And the court said that they had a notice of the injury, and because the spouse was there, they had notice of that potential claim. And because it fell under, and there's other case, the Rosenwide case, that says that if you have a derivative claim and not a separate bystander claim, because it falls within the same statutory cap, you know, it's not getting us any extra damages, really. And they should have notice of the potential claim due to talking to him at the scene of the accident and him being identified on the notice letter. And in fact, in the Aransas case, I don't believe the husband was even on the notice letter. He just was at the scene of the accident and talked to the representatives of the state in that case. And that was sufficient to provide notice to the state.
Okay.
But in this instance, we did include his name on the notice letter. We did talk about the injuries that were incurred by Ms. Williams, and Steve Williams did talk to the UTA police and did talk to the facilities manager at UTA at the time of the accident.
I understood Judge McCoy to be asking what was the loss?
It's just she was
there, but
he was Ms. Williams was a dental hygienist, and the arm that she broke was the arm that allowed her to she was right-handed, and so all of the stuff that she does for the children and the cooking, you know, the keeping up with the house and whatnot. She was laid up for a couple of months, not able to use her arm. And so also the wages to the family were significant loss.
Was that the evidence of loss of consortium?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Well, let me ask you also, you don't happen to know, and it's an off-the-wall question, how many times that recreational statute has been amended since it was enacted?
No, Your Honor, I do not. I'm happy to write a brief on it, though, for you.
No, please don't.
Okay. In conclusion, we would ask this honorable court to affirm the orders of the 352nd Court. One, we don't believe the injury fell within the recreational use statute. based upon this court's previous decision in the Sullivan v. Fort Worth. However, if the court does find that it falls within the recreational use statute, we believe that the record reflects, there are facts that UTA was grossly negligent.
Okay, help me again. I walk in to the facility, and it doesn't need to be Maverick Stadium. I walk over to the bleachers to watch the baseball game. Now, how is that distinguishable from I walk in and I walk over to the picnic table, or I walk to the football field to do my radio control flying?
I don't believe spectating in the sense that the Waco court.
The Waco court, remember, that's the same court that said organized softball is not a recreational activity. So
cut that out.
Let's
okay.
Let's just set that aside. Just common sense. Tell me, what's the distinction between walking to a spot and doing something that makes two of them on the list and one of them not?
I think, for instance, in the picnicking case, there was a case where a lady was.
I'm
just generally talking.
Well,
okay.
Out the window. Let's think common sense. Common law comes from the common sense. Common sense. Tell me what's the difference.
I think it depends on where the picnicking occurred. For instance, let's say you're picnicking in a park.
Here? That's not in here.
Right. Well, in some of the, okay, in the, with the picnicking, you know, there was a lady that a tree branch fell on her, causing her injury. Right. So I think it depends, one, where the picnicking occurred. I believe that if the picnicking occurred, you know, for instance, in the Sullivan case, they equated that type of picnicking where to eating at a restaurant. So I think it kind of depended on the facts of the picnicking. With the radio-controlled airplane, I mean, obviously, you know, that thing could crash in your head. I mean, and the state's not going to be liable for that, of your own misuse of the equipment. You could fly it into a child. I think that's distinguishable.
Okay.
If you're, you know, picnicking at a place where there's a bunch of trees and you get stung by a a bee or a wasp, or you encounter a snake or something of that nature, I think that the park atmosphere, you know, maybe creates some of the danger that why picnicking is included on that list. And bird watching, you know, I didn't even think about it because I know that's a sedentary activity mostly, but if you're in a park and you encounter a snake or I think there was the Kierwin case where the guy was standing on the edge of a cliff and the cliff gave way. It was a natural kind of a natural disaster there, and the state ended up not being liable for that. So I think that's, you know, legislature has said that we don't intend to be liable for things that, you know, are caused by nature. But I don't think this isn't a case that was caused by nature. This is a lady standing next to a railing. You know, the portable stairs were removed. The padlock and the chain were not used in their proper capacity, and that's why this lady fell. Not anything to do with even the soccer game or being outdoors.
Well, so your position would be if the person had been playing baseball and then came over and leaned against the railing, that the recreational use statute would not apply because at that time they were not participating in the recreational activity.
I would agree with that. There's a case that says that there was a man who was playing golf and he had quit playing golf and was walking through and injured himself, and the state found that case, I think it was the city of Dallas, found that case to be included in the recreational use statute. It's in the brief. But, I mean, I believe I would follow the Torres case. The Torres case has said that it matters what you were doing at the time that the injury occurred, not your intent on entering the land.
Okay.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
So you're going to help us out about no fact question on gross negligence.
I am, yes, sir. and y'all, I hope, will pardon me because this gets a little confusing because a lot of the same things I'm going to talk about apply both to whether there's a question on the gross negligence, but also if you drop it down and decide that she's an invitee and it's regular negligence, these same sorts of analysis also apply to whether there's actual constructive knowledge on the part of UTA of the allegedly dangerous condition. But the primary reason I would say that there's not a question with respect to gross negligence is Shimaki in that line of cases. And essentially, when you look at Shimaki, what you find is that was an allegation of gross negligence. And one of the things that the court that's just imperative to that, because right when you have a gross negligence analysis, you're talking about actual knowledge of an extreme degree of risk, the probability and the magnitude of the potential harm, okay? But the key is the actual knowledge. And what you had in Shimaki was a case where there was a culvert built where people were swimming that when you couldn't see it from above the water, right? So it was hidden. pardon me. But this culvert created like an undertow that was in the water. And what happened was is when you went swimming in the body water, you got pulled into the culvert because of the undertow. And pardon me, my allergies are killing me. But the question in that case was okay, so what is the actual knowledge on the part of the state? Now, the culvert was man-made. It was concrete. It was created by the state. But the question is, how did the state know that it was dangerous? And the answer to that question, how did the state know that it was dangerous, is because prior to the individual who was killed that resulted in the bringing of the Shimaki case, the state had been warned three different times by swimmers. And this was documented, and this was in the record, that where swimmers had come forth to the agency that was involved, I think it was Parks and Wildlife, and they said, the culvert makes an undertow. When people go swimming in this water, they get sucked into the undertow, somebody's going to get killed. They got told that by three different people on three different occasions. And at that point, they know that the culvert's there. They've had these complaints from these three individuals that say, hey, when you go swimming in this body of water, you get sucked under. That's how the actual knowledge comes into play. And so the question is, how do you get to whether there's a fact question about gross negligence? You compare what happens in Shimaki with what happens in Flynn and in Hughes that are both cited in the brief. And in Flynn and Hughes especially, the court goes into this exact analysis. It's a Dallas court, I believe. And in Hughes, what they say is, you know, when there's only a single allegation, and the single allegation is the one that's also the basis of the lawsuit, then that's not going to be enough to create a fact question on a fact issue on gross negligence.
What about the testimony of Thomas Closa?
Well, the testimony of Thomas Closa was that he had worked for UTA in that stadium for 28 years. In all of the 28 years that Mr. Closa had worked at UTA at that stadium, he had understood that those gates had been closed by wrapping a chain around them and putting a lock on them. In those 28 years, no chain had ever failed while there were spectators around. No one had ever fallen. No one had ever been injured in
but
those 28 years.
They had failed when spectators weren't around.
Well, they had failed while they were inspecting them, and that's true. And that's sort of where we get into this sort of whether there's actual or constructive knowledge of it, because naturally when they were operating the locks and chains, in other words, when they were moving the stairs away or putting them out, when the chain had to be, they were checking them. They were inspecting them when they were in use. Now, but the question is whether or not they had actual knowledge of an extreme degree of risk, a probability and magnitude. And probability comes when something has happened that lets you know that these chains fail when people lean against them, and it's probably going to happen again. That's Shimaki versus Hughes and Flynn. But in this case, they in the 28 years that the eight gates that are around the stadium had been secured in this way, they had never failed while spectators were around. They had never, and they had never resulted in any injury. And so in order for there to be a fact question on gross negligence, you have to have that actual knowledge of the extreme degree of risk. And once again, to the extent that you only have one allegation, and that one allegation is also the basis of the lawsuit, then once again, when you look at Hughes, when you look at Flynn, when you compare it to Shimaki, you see, well, but that's not enough to create the actual knowledge that's needed to make an allegation of gross negligence. And I believe that that's why there's not a fact question on gross negligence in this case.
I'm not sure I buy that the dog gets one free bite. I mean, what you're telling us is the first time that happens, by definition, you can't be grossly negligent.
That's correct.
Well, let's say the guy, last time he repaired it, the day before this accident, I mean, he didn't put the lock on it. He just had the chain there. So your position would be, well, no gross negligence because it hadn't happened before.
Well, and I think that there are actually a couple of issues with that. Yes, I believe that once again, first off, I think it's important to note that that's far from the facts here. The facts here were that when they used the locks, they inspected them. But once again, when you're looking at like Corbin and that line of cases, like the grape cases, right, where there's a grape on the ground, and so you say, well, the grocery store knew they should have had a mat there because they knew that grapes were there. I mean, you know, you'd have to charge them with constructive knowledge in this case, right? Because there's not any evidence that they had actual knowledge of it. And so when you're looking at whether there's constructive knowledge, it's like you don't even get to that first step in the grape cases. Because in the grape cases, there's no question that those grocery stores knew that when grapes got on the ground, people slipped on them. But once again, in this case, you know, you characterize it as first bite free, but essentially that's the analysis. You know, if they didn't know that it was dangerous.
So if the specifications called for concrete to be a certain mix and the contractor came and said, hey, the inspector said the concrete isn't the mix it's supposed to be, it's much too weak, and there's a real danger. In fact, I predict that this part of the bleachers will collapse. You're saying that the stadium folks could say, well, we won't fix it because that way we won't know about it. We'll just ignore it and let it collapse two or three times, and that's what it's going to take for us to be on notice, even though you have been told that the concrete has too much sand. If you ignore it until it collapses two or three times, then you're okay. Is that what you're saying?
It is not what I'm saying, Your Honor. Once again, I think what distinguishes the facts that we have from your hypothetical is that there was no one that told them ahead of time that these locks were faulty. In fact, the mechanism had worked perfectly well on all eight of those gates for 28 years. It was not an issue of that they knew for a fact that this material was bad, not necessarily because of degradation, because I think that's a completely different issue. But if you're saying because at the initial construction it was not done correctly, the concrete was not mixed right, and UTA knew about that, I do think that would probably be an allegation of gross negligence against UTA.
Didn't Closa testify they used the wrong kind of lock?
No, he testified that later on that as a remedial measure they said what you should do is put the latch back on that. But once again, if you look at, let's see here, I believe it's the CMH case. CMH says that an allegation that after the fact, after the incident, that there was like a better design or the more feasible design, that also does not rise to the level of gross negligence. The fact that after the fact someone else comes in and says, hey, you guys should have had a latch on this. Once again, when you look at CMS, the Supreme Court says that's not enough to make an allegation of gross negligence. And I believe that that's essentially the situation that you've described.
Oh, go on. No. I'm bothered by this one free time before you can get to gross negligence. What if somebody's the gatekeeper goes to lock the gate and he's about gone on drugs and he locks the one link next to the next link in the same part of the chain so that it's not locked at all, and then he dies. He's so out of it.
Right.
That couldn't be gross negligence because it hadn't happened before?
Well, once again, I think that goes to this notion of inspection. You know, if you have that fact pattern that you've sort of laid out, and then there's also evidence in the record that says, well, if UTA had performed reasonable inspections, it would have discovered that. Then
assume it was his job to lock it and inspect it.
Sure. Well, once again, then that would be an allegation of improper inspection or a not reasonable inspection. But once again, to the extent that there's not evidence in the record that was the case, that the individual, you know, that it was not done correctly and an inspection would have discovered that, then once again, I don't think you're, and I realize that I'm sort of mixing the negligence with the gross negligence, but I think the analysis is very similar. You know, what you've got to find is that there's evidence in the record that UTA should have conducted a better inspection of it and that it didn't, and had it conducted a correct inspection or a reasonable inspection, that it would have discovered it. But once again, that's not what this record is. There's no indication about the length of time that the lock was allegedly broken. There's no allegation that, you know, had they inspected it once a week instead of once every 2 weeks, that would have discovered it. Those things are simply not in the record.
Okay. And, well, with respect to this one bite, dog gets a free bite, what you're doing is you're mixing gross negligence and causation. there can be gross negligence by definition, and it never caused an accident. So that's why there's no one bite rule. You can be grossly negligent, it just maybe has never caused an accident yet.
Sure.
So,
but I believe
one bite rule, that dog doesn't hunt.
Well, but I believe that it's specifically, though, that simply the allegation that
bite.
That
joke. Well, maybe it wasn't.
That that simply the allegation that they failed to warn because they put up a sign, which is the allegation here, or that they failed to maintain the lock. Once again, that's not enough to rise to gross negligence. Once again, you're not talking about UTA doing nothing with respect to this gate. You're talking about UTA employing a mechanism of closing this gate that it believed was safe, that it believed was going to protect the spectators, and it had that belief based on the fact that for 28 years prior to the incident that we're talking about today, it had done exactly that. And so we're not talking about a situation where it's obvious to everybody that it's going to be very dangerous, because what they did was they implemented a plan that they believed was going to keep their spectators safe. And because they did that, once again, it's not this sort of outlandish or dog-related incident.
All right. Any other questions? Thank you. We appreciate your argument. We appreciate you coming all this way. It's been very helpful. As you can tell, we had lots of questions. Your case is submitted, and you are released to go about your business. Again, we appreciate you being here, and this court will be adjourned.
Thank you, Your Honor.